Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 182 of the Intercooler Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. This week we're talking forbidden fruit, the cars that were never sold or that are not currently sold in the UK. There's some really interesting stuff that falls into that category. We've got big, heavy, very powerful American muscle cars, tax dodge special Italian supercars, tiny little K cars from Japan, all sorts of stuff, and a handful that we are not sad never came to the UK as well. But before we get started, I will just remind you all to subscribe or follow the podcast. So whatever app you're using, hit the little follow button or the subscribe button. It means you don't miss an episode and it also helps us out enormously. So please do consider doing that. And thank you very much for listening. We're not just going to do the cars that we don't get or didn't get in the UK that we're sad about. I think we're going to do a few less good cars that we are quite glad were never sold here. But before we get onto the main topic, a little bit of Bernie Eccleston, Andrew.
Sorry, why am I laughing?
It's just an extraordinary story.
You'd have thought that once you're retired from the business in, you know, what's he, 92, I think?
Yeah.
You kind of thought that the Bernie Eccleston story was kind of over now, having been, you know, sort of front and centre of the Formula One world for, half a century at least. But no. No, he's popped up. He quite clearly copped a plea, hasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
To avoid being dragged through the courts. And I think it was in everybody's interest that, I'm sure it was decided that it was in everybody's interest he should just plead guilty. So he has been found guilty of failing to declare 400 million quid.
Mm-hmm.
Which he should have declared. But he's also agreed to pay back £652 million.
Unbelievable.
Which I think are tax arrears accumulated over the last 18 years. And he's been sentenced to go to prison for 17 months, but it's been suspended for 2 years, which means if he behaves himself for the next 2 years, he doesn't go to prison, which means he doesn't go to prison.
Yeah.
So, you could send him to life imprisonment and suspend it for it's, in terms of the custodial bit, it's meaningless, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
It's absolutely meaningless. So basically what has happened is he has been made to pay back what he owes, or a proportion of what he owes. And the astonishing thing is that he's looking down the barrel of a bill of nearly 2/3 of £1 billion. I don't think he's going to notice it.
I do wonder, so what's he worth? 2 or 3 billion.
Two and a half billion, they reckon.
But who knows? But where is that money? You know, is it liquid? Is it cash? Can he just do a wire, a bank transfer for that money, or is it in property?
I suspect they'll allow staged repayments.
Yes, I'm sure over time.
You know, if it's 50 million here, 50 million. I mean, the numbers are just so astronomical. And we laugh. I guess we laugh. And I suppose somebody, an altogether better person than me, would be thinking about what all that money could have bought in all that period of time that it wasn't paid over, and clearly the ultimate intention was never to pay it, so what he might have got away with, but you know, I don't know. It is, I mean, I can't understand the numbers.
No, they're meaningless to us, aren't they? But there will be a lot of people out there who maybe they did time for tax fraud, or they know people who did for relatively meaningless amounts, and perhaps they will feel they weren't offered the opportunity to plea bargain their way out of a custodial sentence. So I'm sure there are people out there who feel quite aggrieved at all this.
I mean, there's a book which was written by a bloke called Crispian Besley. I think it's called Driven to Crime. I know Crispian a little bit, not much. He races old cars, and I've bumped into him at a few tracks and that sort of thing. But it's a book that's just got all these cases in it. Mm. I mean, absolutely, you know, going way back on both sides of the Atlantic, all around the world, of people who have been involved in nefarious activity in the world of motor racing, basically since the start of motor racing. And it's a really interesting read. But with all these things, and I'm sure with this Bernie thing now, the sense that they always leave me with is, this is what is known.
Gosh.
Yeah. How much remains unknown? And of course, you can't know the unknown, the unknowable, can you? But you always get the impression with these guys that what you actually find out about is so utterly different and far removed from what the real whole truth is that you'll never get the full picture. Mm. You'll never get an understanding of what the nature of any deals made with the authorities or whatever, or the real amounts of money used, or perhaps, you know, in other cases, the amounts of money which weren't discovered and therefore weren't paid back. I don't know. But
do you know what? I've got a sort of analogy here. Whenever I watch, or certainly in recent years, the England rugby team, and they're constantly getting called out for violations in the scrum or the ruck or the maul, and their discipline just seems nowhere. And I just think to myself, why do they keep doing it? And I guess it's because most of the time they're getting away with it.
Of course, because they wouldn't do it otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's so much nefarious stuff going on. And a lot of the time they get away with it.
I mean, you know, generally speaking, as crime as a whole, certainly in the UK, 2% of crimes result in a conviction.
Is that the figure?
2%, yeah. So if you commit a crime, you have a 1 in 50 chance of being nicked for it. Or certainly being convicted of it. 1 in 50.
Almost makes it seem worthwhile.
So how much stuff has gone on which we don't know about? Yeah. I was, as you know, at Rennsport in America the other day. And there was a car there which I'd never seen before. Which was the Porsche 935, which won Le Mans in 1979, and you'll remember the race. It's the famous race because Paul Newman, aka Oscar-winning film star, Paul Newman was in the 935 that came second. But the one that won was driven by, well, Klaus Ludwig, who is an amazing professional racing driver, and the Whittington brothers, Bill and Don Whittington. Mm. And these guys, what they got up to, I think one of them's still alive, so I maybe have to be a little bit careful. But they were major, major, major drug smugglers.
Mm.
And there was all sorts of financial impropriety. And I mean, just go and read about the Whittington brothers. I mean, and Randy Lanier, do you remember him?
Yeah. We did, a few months ago, maybe a couple of years ago, we did do an episode on motorsport and crime, didn't we? But it's rife. And the world of fast cars, and particularly racing, does seem to attract a lot of these characters, or it has in the past.
I think for a lot of these guys, A, it's fun and it's glamorous and it's everything else, but I suspect it's also, and I'm not saying this in relation to anybody in particular, but I suspect it's also a really good place to park or recycle dodgy money, isn't it?
Yeah, you can clean a lot of money in racing, I'm sure.
Yeah, and there are lots of expensive things you can buy if you just want to park money out for a bit.
Anyway,
before we get ourselves into all amounts of trouble,
yes, let's leave that there.
Should we go talk about something?
Did you see? Did you see Bernie after he accepted the plea bargain? He was photographed buying donuts at Borough Market.
Yeah, well, Karoon sent something through.
Yes,
Bernie
did.
Standing at a donut store.
Didn't seem terribly bothered, did he? Anyway,
that is so Bernie, isn't it?
It really is.
Yes, it's just brilliant.
So
excellent. Okay,
the cars that we don't get or didn't get here in the UK. Now there are lots and lots of reasons why certain cars don't make it into certain territories. There are sort of legislative things. Emissions is a big one these days. Local markets just not feeling like there's a business case. Some cars are not offered in right-hand drive, which is a problem.
That's a really significant one. Mm. I won't be able to name them all by any means, but there aren't that many right-hand drive car markets in the world. There's the UK, there's Australia, there's Japan.
Yeah, New Zealand.
A few others, yeah, but not many.
No.
And
South Africa.
So, you know, South Africa, yeah. And so if you're doing something quite low volume, I mean, engineering a car for right-hand drive is not the matter of a moment, and it ain't cheap.
Mm.
And sometimes, as we know, for instance, the Lancia Delta Integrale was never made in right-hand drive form. So they just sold it over here in left-hand drive form, which were clearly... So there are lots of cars which weren't made, but which did get sold over here anyway. And in Japan, having a left-hand drive car is a sort of bit of a badge of honour, isn't it? Having the steering wheel on the wrong side of the car for some peculiar reason I don't really understand. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
And then there are lots of cars that are just not well-suited to the UK, little old UK.
Are they very, very big cars or very, very small cars?
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. We prefer them in the middle, don't we? So, God, there are loads that we can get through across the ages as well. I'm going to give you one just because it's at the top of my list. And it's a car that I know you don't particularly regard that fondly. I do. Alfa Romeo Giulia Quadrifoglio.
With a manual gearbox.
Yeah, you can get one with a manual gearbox. And I'd start with it because I have driven one. We had one on Evo Car of the Year 1 year. 2014, I think. Maybe a bit later. Maybe it was 16.
I was going to say, it hasn't been around that long, has it?
No, I think it was 16 then. It was dreadful. Dreadful. I hated it. It was a horrible, heavy, bulky, notchy shift. It felt like a truck gearbox. The clutch pedal weighting was horrible. The pedal spacing was weird. I just hated driving. I thought it totally ruined the car. The auto was so much better. So, you know, we moan about not getting a manual option, particularly in a performance car.
Yeah.
Not always a good thing.
Okay, so here's another example of exactly that. But I've always wondered. You could buy a manual E60 M5 in the US.
Mm. Yeah.
And I've heard that that's not a great gearbox, but even so, it would have to be pretty rubbish. Well, particularly given that the paddle shift gearbox in that car was not exactly ideal, to put it mildly. And I think any kind of stick shifter in that, with that engine, I mean, that would have been quite an event, wouldn't it?
I guess so. I do remember hearing that it's not a very good gearbox. Maybe the ratios aren't great. But
don't care.
Yeah, I kind of get that. You just want to try it, don't you?
It's a manual V10.
Saloon car. Yeah.
Okay. Saloon car.
Just because this is on topic. You can, in certain markets, you can buy manual versions of the current M3 and M4. The trouble is, they're the basic ones, the non-competition models.
Yeah.
Here in the UK, we only get competition cars. So there's some spreadsheet wizard in Farnborough who has looked at it and gone, there's no point bringing the basic models in because people just want the competition, versions, so we're not going to bring them in.
And you can't get a manual with the comps.
No, you can't, exactly. So for decades, ever since the very first, the E30 M3, you've been able to buy a manual M3. But for a purely commercial reason, now here in the UK, the manual M3 and the M4 no longer a thing. Am I concerned about that?
And also, you know, those lower powered versions of that S58 engine, I mean, they're not exactly shonky, are they?
No, they're not.
You know, you think of the engine in your M2. It's an absolutely cracking unit.
Yeah.
And that's probably got lower power than a standard M3 or M4.
Mm.
And you can get that with a manual gearbox. I mean, to me, it's just another reason to go and buy an M2 comp, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. The manual cars are 25 kilograms lighter than the auto, the 8-speed auto cars that we do get, which is something. So I'd quite like to try one of those, an M3 or an M4, and just see if a simpler, slightly more old school car is more fun to drive.
I agree with you, but I've no doubt at all BMW are right. Those cars, they just sell on the numbers, don't they?
Yeah.
They sell on the power and the 0-60 and everything else, both of which are, if you have less power in a manual gearbox, that's going to really affect you on paper performance. And you don't want to, I mean, I can't really believe I'm saying this, but you don't want to be the one that's in the car that doesn't get under four. So, I mean, it's what appears to, for some reason, I will never understand it, appears to be what's important.
Well, and also, once you've spec'd a car, put your deposit down, signed up to a PCP, it's probably not that much more to upgrade to the competition, and the vast majority of buyers would have done that. And so it is much simpler for BMW UK just to bring in the competition versions. Makes sense.
Agreed. Yeah.
Right. Go on then.
Where could we go? I was in America, maybe 2 years ago, and I drove a Shelby Mustang 500 GT, which is the Mustang with a 750 horsepower, 5.4-litre supercharged engine.
Blimey.
I'm not saying it should go on sale. I'm not certainly not saying that they didn't really maybe even sell it. I just thought it would be the ultimate sort of blunt instrument and it would end up really quite annoying me. But it didn't.
Mm.
And I'm sure it's an environmental thing because I was driving it in some fairly wide open spaces. But I did think it was pretty amazing. And I love the idea that cars like that, which are so true to the original values of the muscle car, as the original pony car was the Mustang when it came out in 64, I think. And just, let's just see how much power, and, you know, and things like Dodge Hellcats and all these sorts of things, which you can't buy over here.
Yeah, well, actually, I was going to say that there's a load of them. There's things like the Chevrolet Camaro ZL1, the Cadillac CT5V Blackwing, and the Dodge Challenger Hellcat Red Eye.
Oh, the Red Eye, that's the big one, isn't it? That's the one with nearly 800 horsepower.
So there are tons of these, the sort of proper Detroit Iron US muscle type things with massive power, almost 800 horsepower sometimes.
And you kind of get the impression, don't you, that they're, and there's this sense, isn't it, that we're all sort of drinking in the last chance saloon.
Yeah.
We all know that it's, that the game's up, and so we're all just getting plastered before it is. And, I suspect if you had one of those on our sort of, our beloved Welsh mountain roads, it would be,
compromised.
If it was a bit wet, it would be compromised, to say the least. But when I drive this, okay, so there's another one, and this is going back a bit. The original ZR1 Corvette, so this would have been the C4 Corvette, so this would have come out in 88, 89. This is the one that Lotus worked on.
Oh.
Did the 4-cam 32-valve heads for the LT1 small block engine. Gave it, I think, maybe, sort of 400 horsepower. And you could turn half the valves off. It had a switch in it.
Mm.
So
oh, really?
If you're stupid enough to let your kid go out and have a go in it, he could go out in a 16-valve, and then when you came home, you could have all 32.
Wow.
And it was... The thing about that car was... and actually going to its launch, which was Miraval, the Goodyear test track in the south of France. It was one of the first launches I went on. It was the first American car I'd driven that really, really handled.
Mm.
Because you just think to yourself, well, these cars, they've got big V8s and they make lots of noise and they're cool and they go really fast, but come on, they're not real driving machines. This was...
Mm.
It would drift and drift and drift, and it was precise and it was accurate. I mean, the interior was absolutely appalling, but it was a proper driver's car.
Mm.
It really was, and that never came over here. But yeah, original C4 ZR1 Corvette, cracking car.
So that, yeah, that's another good example. There's so many of these US cars that look on paper just tantalising. And when they're cheap in the US, but when you do the conversion to sterling, it's unbelievable. So the CT5V Blackwing, 668 horsepower, it's equal to £62,000. My BMW M2 that I've got outside is £65,000 before options. It's got 450 horsepower. It's unbelievable.
Okay. All right. So let us say... But that's presumably just a straight conversion.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, so you're not going to buy one.
So you haven't got it back here or put it through SVO or anything else. But let us just say they were the same price. And you had the two manufacturers competing for your attention and saying, come on, Dan, you know, have a Blackwing or somebody else saying, have an M2 comp for the next 6 months. You'd still have an M2 comp parked outside, wouldn't you?
For here, yeah. For the UK, yeah. Yeah.
And that's the point. However amused you might be by the idea of a 668 horsepower nutter from over there, for here, for these roads, if you lived in America...
Yeah, different matter.
Probably. And I was about to say, because petrol's so cheap over there, but when I was over there in California the week before last, actually petrol's not cheap at all anymore.
Yeah, but is it getting close to our prices, or is it...
Yes, it absolutely is. It absolutely... Yeah. And I remember, I'm so bloody old, I can remember when it was... 99 cents a gallon. And okay,
gallon.
So that's a US gallon. A gallon. So that's 99 cents per US gallon, which is only 85% of one of my gallons. But it still works out at about £1.15 for a proper gallon.
Yeah. That is unbelievable cheap. It's not unbelievably cheap.
And that was at the time like sort of a third of the price. It was probably £3 a gallon over here then at the same time. Now it's like £7 or £8.
Mm. Yeah. So that is changing for them. But yeah, I have driven a lot of imported muscle cars from the US in the UK, even just a fairly basic V8 Camaro a few years ago, and it, manual gearbox, and it had that big V8, and it is super characterful, and I think they look cool, but they, on our tiny nadgy little bumpy roads, they are compromised and they are quite like hard work. So
I did a... Okay, no, so this is slightly off topic because I'm talking about a car which was on sale over here. But I did a twin test when I was running a Focus ST a couple of years back. I did a twin test with that and a Bullitt Mustang in Wales. Focus killed it.
Yeah, it would.
Focus absolutely killed it. I mean, absolutely in pure straight line terms, probably not, but... in every other way. And it was so much quicker point to point, despite its lack of, because it was so much more agile and nimble and easy and actually fun. I mean, I love the way the Bullitt looked and I love the way it sounded. And if you're driving it at 6/10 and you're just rumbling along, it's wonderful. But actually, if you want to drive these things, fast,
I actually really like the Bullitt, but I totally understand why a good Focus hot hatch would just blitz it down a tricky road.
Yeah.
On the subject of American muscle. Chevy Camaro, must get this right, Z28. So this is the one that was first shown in 2013, but it was 2015 by the time we got one at Evo Car of the Year. On the North Coast 500, it was a brilliant week, actually, that one. So we travelled all around the north of Scotland with some amazing cars. And this Z28, goodness me, we borrowed it off an owner who had just imported it. We were all just terrified of it. Because it...
Is this a thing with a 305 section front tyre?
Yeah, enormous front tyres. So huge.
Yeah.
It tram lines anyway. It's got all that rubber on the road at the front axle, and it does hunt out grooves and ruts in the road. And there are a lot of those on those brilliant roads up there. But the other issue was that the tyre pressures, and we only realised this later on, the tyre pressures were all wrong on that car. It'd been sat on a boat for weeks. That tram lining tendency was amplified massively. And so you'd just be driving along the straight line, you'd change gear, and all of a sudden you were halfway into the other lane, and you didn't know why. So everyone was just spooked by that car. But then our mate Chris Harris had one for a while, and I borrowed his for a video three, 4 years ago probably, and drove that in South Wales. Tyre pressures were fine. I'm sure the car was better as well. And it was brilliant. I loved it.
Oh, do you know what? I drove that. I drove Chris's. He came out when we were doing some race in Belgium together, probably 4 or 5 years ago. He came out in that car. And it's fair to say that the journey from where we were staying into the track was usually accomplished at a reasonably
go on
an energetic rate. And I can actually, I remember exactly when it was. It was we'd done quali, and the problem with that particular event is that you have to do night qualifying. There's a particular restaurant we like eating in, and we were worried they were going to give the table away, so we were in a proper hurry, and I just got on this thing and legged it off up, and it was, I was really impressed by it.
Yeah, really good fun.
I mean, it's all about the environment, isn't it?
Yeah.
But in wide open spaces, when you're in a hurry and you're on a sort of Belgian motorway,
and you're on the right side as well,
and you're on the correct side, it was it was mega
phenomenal engine. Good gear shift as well. Just, really enjoyable and just so different to a typically modern European sports car that's all about, you know, precision and turbo torque and paddle shift and all that stuff. It was just, it was refreshing. Go on then, let's have another of yours.
Can I go completely the other way?
Yes, you can.
And this will be it. I think this is one of the best design cars that there has ever been. You will never have driven one.
Mm-hmm.
But in its own very particular way, when this thing came out, it completely knocked us out. So much so that Autocar bought one, even though it wasn't sold in the UK, and we had it for years, and it was amazing. The original Renault Twingo.
Wow. You still see them knocking about in parts of France, don't you?
You still see them knocking. I mean, they were just, it was almost, it was one of those kind of like sort of, you know, mini moments. You know, a car just comes along and it just seems to be able to do something with its space, which doesn't correlate at all to, you know, what you're looking at. It was such a clever car. It was such a small car, but there was so much space in it. And it was just really, really nice thing to knock about. And it probably had, I don't know, I don't think it would have had a 1.4 in it. Probably had a 1.1. Might have had a 1.0 something. I mean, it's some very, very small engine. But we did huge mileages. I remember Steve Sutcliffe drove it to Northern Italy and back.
Wow.
And it's just, and we just couldn't understand. Well, that's not true, actually. I think we understood absolutely why it wasn't sold in the UK. It wasn't sold in the UK because Renault got it wrong. They thought it was just some sort of little niche car. It was something that they could, I think it was basically, it was the idea was it to was to for it to kind of replace the lowly entry-level Renault 5 Clio-type cars. And it wouldn't sell very many, but what it would do, it would get people on the Renault sort of ladder, and then maybe they come back and buy, you know, a dozen more Renaults after that. And they didn't ever think it would do big numbers. But of course, it was rapturously received. But by which stage, the car was tooled up, ready for production, and could never be made in right-hand drive because it wasn't, I don't think it was made as a symmetrical car, so they just couldn't do it. Every time I think, it's just silly, actually, because, you know, people will say, well, it's just some little French shitbox. But every time I think of that car, and I'm looking back, you know, 30 years now, it was absolutely cracking. It was just one of those really imaginative, innovative, light, well-designed, well-thought-out little French cars, which we love so much. And we always talk about Renault 4s and Renault 5s and 2CVs and 205s, and because they were never sold over here, the Twingo never gets in on that conversation. No. But it should.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, I'm going a totally different direction. Toyota Century.
God, do you really? Oh, no, we're just talking about cars which weren't sold over here, whether we wanted them to be or not.
The Japanese Rolls Royce. Actually,
sell the Century to me.
It sort of looks a bit like a Rolls Royce, but it's more like an S-Class, isn't it, in terms of price and size. So this is the sort of Japanese plutocratic luxury saloon thing that I think it's only really sold in Japan in very small numbers, and it's really just for Japanese businessmen to be driven around Tokyo and wherever else. There used to be V12. You can no longer get a V12. They're V8 hybrid these days.
Why are we having this conversation?
But they are just built to be driven in. And I suspect when you are riding in the back of one, maybe taking phone calls or whatever else, I'm sure it's lovely. And the earlier ones, they had a panel in the passenger seat, the front passenger seat, that would fold down so that the rear seat passenger could put their legs through.
Sorry?
Yeah.
There was a hole in the front passenger seat.
Yeah, a flap that would come down, and then it becomes a footstool for the rear seat passenger. And then the driver has to deal with your smelly feet.
I was going
to
say, so your poor sod of a chauffeur, not content with having to, you know, spend his life ferrying you around the place,
yeah,
you know, then has to put up with your with your honking socks on the seat next to him. Wow!
And they have these joy. White sort of frilly doily curtains and just totally bizarre.
Oh yeah,
bizarre.
But you get those. You can't get into. You can't get into a minivan anywhere in the Far East or in Africa or anywhere like that without doily curtains.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's true. So, yeah, Toyota Century. I'm not sure I really miss those cars not being sold over here in the UK, but quite interesting.
But if somebody got one over here, maybe someone does. You'd want to have a go,
wouldn't
you?
Yeah, you would, yeah. You'd want to be driven in it, no question, just to see.
Yes.
Weird thing.
Oh, well, can I do another Toyota? I'm not even going to give it a name because it has so many different names, and it's a Toyota in some countries, and it's an and it's a Lexus in others, and it's an Amazon, and it's this. But it is what you and I would recognise as the Toyota Land Cruiser Amazon. Mm. So the big Land Cruiser, the Land Cruiser that doesn't get sold over here. You know, so they do a standard Land Cruiser, which is it's a very traditional, conventionally proportioned 7-seat SUV. And then they did this big one, which they sold over here for years and years and years. And the last one was a V8 diesel. Which is an absolutely brilliant car. In fact, a mate of mine's got one, which he will not sell. But they still make it and they still sell it. And I was reminded of it because I was in one for actually very early. Was it early this year? It was early this year. When's the Dakar? It is it's January, isn't it? Yeah. So I was in one in Saudi early this year, roaming around the desert trying to keep up with the Dakar rally. And the thing about these cars is they have a sense of indestructibility that you just don't get in any other car. I know someone who's a mechanic and has looked under them. So basically they're built like lorries. And they are so robust.
Yeah.
And to me, they've always had this charm. I also think they're extremely cool. So when I go to race meetings and all the cars are turning up being towed by newish Range Rovers and, you know, Cayennes, and I don't look at any of those. And then the bloke in the ratty 20-year-old Amazon turns up and I think, yeah, okay, so that's
proper.
That's someone who understands what matters in life. And yeah, and they are, proper is the word. They are so immensely proper. I always have loved them, and I thought it was such a shame that they just stopped selling them in the UK.
It's what you choose for the apocalypse, isn't it?
Yeah.
For the end times, you'd want to be in an Amazon.
Yeah, or just lost in the middle of a desert. Mm. Yeah. And you need something which is going to keep going. And what we put these things through in the desert, and we were leaping them off dunes and smashing them about, and all bits sorts of things fell off them. But you know, they never looked like stopping.
Yeah. Wow.
Mega things.
Okay, so kind of similar. In the US, I think they probably call them SUVs, but goodness me, I think they're something else. Things like the Cadillac Escalade and the Chevrolet Suburban, those enormous. 4x4, whatever. But they are vast.
I don't want them in the UK.
No, they would not work here. They would not work here. But I remember a bunch of us went to Texas to do a tyre test. And I don't know, there were 4 or 5 of us. And we got a Chevrolet Suburban hire car. And actually, when you've got 4 or 5 blokes and some kit and all your luggage, they are fantastic. Because you can pile into the back, and even in the back seats, the rearmost seats, you don't feel like you're riding squashed up in the back of some little European MPV. You're lounging out. you've got all the space in the world. And so for being driven around Texas, I can't argue with them.
There is a big but, and I say this as someone who within the last fortnight has spent 3 hours sitting in the back of a sub. Because I happened to be in one from San Francisco down to Monterey.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what these cars are like. I mean, they're basically built on truck chassis. Yeah. So they're basically, it's a ladder chassis with a body bolted on top of them, and they have live rear axles.
Yeah, so they don't ride, do they? They're not luxurious.
Well, actually, funny enough, you're in the front, and I announced that I was not getting on the way back there, but I announced that I wasn't going in the back. If you're in the front, they're fine. Because, you know, you've got, I think, what are they on the front? They've probably got wishbones or something. They've got properly independent suspension. But if you're sat on the back of that axle as it's jolting around all the bumps on the freeway, yeah, that's not a lot of fun. And they're also those sorts of cars. Actually, one of the road trips I remember most fondly was I drove a sub. It was a really old one. It had a 7.4 litre V8 in it from Fort Lauderdale up to Atlanta and beyond, so up into the Carolinas in about 1992. And actually, in that, so just wandering up the interstate, listening to local radio, which I always love listening to local radio, and just sort of disappearing into the scenery and turning into sort of, you know, a local American lad in his sub, which had done a bazillion miles. I actually, you know, it fitted that world and that purpose so unbelievably well. And I would love to have gone on and on and on and driven it, you know, thousands of miles. So, yeah, fine. But I have no interest in driving one over here.
No, imagine trying to drive one through Bath or through central London. Just horrendous.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
What about the Nissan Z? The new one, the current one, the latest Z car.
Oh, yeah, it's a good call.
So you can have a manual, 400 horsepower twin turbo V6, limited slip diff. Because of emissions, it's never sold here. It won't be sold here. But yeah, I mean, these days we sort of lament. I suppose actually my M2 is a very similar kind of thing. But there aren't that many cars like it on sale these days, so from that point of view, it is a shame that we don't get that Nissan over
It's a shame, because also, you know, those Z cars, so the 350 and the 370, I mean, they're not difficult cars to criticise.
No.
But I've always liked them because they are honest and they get the important stuff right. The engines are good, the gearboxes are good, the handling's well balanced. They're just nice things to drive. Absolutely, all sorts of limitations with, you know, living them and that sort of thing. But I can only imagine that the new one is more of the same. It'll be a fraction of the price of a Cayman. It won't be as good as a Cayman, but I just think the world is a better place with those sorts of cars in it. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I've never driven it, so maybe it's a rubbish car. I suspect it's not. I suspect it's quite good, and I suspect that for the kind of money that it would cost were it on sale over here, you'd think, actually, that's not a bad shot.
Yeah, totally agree. We need to talk about K-cars, don't we?
We do. Would you like to explain what a K-car is?
Okay.
This is not a car powered by a Rover K-series engine.
So these are built for the Japanese domestic market. Really, they're designed for Japanese cities.
JDMs.
Yeah, they're designed for Japanese cities, and they're built to very, very particular strict regulations that governing their size. Yeah. They have to be very narrow, very short. What's the limit? 660 cc's. So tiny, yes. Tiny little engines.
Yeah.
And these things crawl all over Tokyo and other Japanese cities, don't they? They're everywhere.
Yeah. We should have had Joe on this podcast. Yeah. So our contributor, Joanna Fidalgo, she's a bit of a K-car fan, to put it mildly. And she's had her Suzuki Cappuccino for quite a long time, despite the fact that it has cost her not a small amount of money keeping it in nice condition. And she's just bought a Toyota Serra.
Yeah, although I don't think the Serra is a K-car.
I'm sorry?
I don't think it is. It's got a 1.5 litre engine. I think it's much bigger. Yeah. But so...
Okay. But it certainly wasn't... Okay, but it qualifies for our purposes because it was never sold in the UK.
Yes, it does. It does. You're right.
So I'm having it.
You're right. Yeah.
So it's an honorary K car.
It was on my list because it's... So we were talking to Joe about them at Bista Heritage, weren't we, last week? Apparently, so... They were built between 90 and 96. Japan only, 15,000 or so were built. Apparently 70-odd have been brought into the UK. So there are a few knocking about, but they've got the butterfly doors, haven't they? Or whatever you want to call them.
Oh, the gullwing doors, actually. Yeah.
And I was just reading about them this morning. The inspiration for the McLaren F1's butterfly doors come from the Toyota Serra. This is from our friends at Car Magazine. Gordon Murray's quoted as saying, "I drove past the Serra every day, eventually reborrowed one, and the design for the F1 started from there."
Wow.
So there you go.
Wow. Well, that's a good claim to fame, isn't it? We inspired the McLaren F1.
That's not bad. It's not a bad legacy.
No.
So
I've driven a Serra in Japan. It's like I drove it in kind of quite heavy traffic through Tokyo and Yokohama. And again, it's kind of like driving a Suburban on the Florida interstate. It's just all about the environment. And the Serra worked really well at that. I mean, so I like the way they looked. And I just like the fact that these small, quite affordable, but yet really characterful cars exist.
Mm.
Things like the Daihatsu Copen, Nissan Figaro, obviously the Cappuccino was sold over here. I'm not sure about the other ones. But there was some quite cool stuff.
And so if you go to Tokyo, you will see scores of tiny little K cars running around, and so you've listed a few of the sportier ones, but most of them are very boxy, very upright. Really, they're family cars, aren't they? They're five-door cars. You're supposed to be able to get family.
You can get vans and little trucks as well,
little,
can't you?
Little dump trucks and all sorts.
Yeah, yeah.
They're brilliant. And
talk about bonsai cars.
Talk about fitness for purpose.
Mm.
In the middle of a packed city.
Yeah.
That's what you want to be in, probably.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Do you want to do some more?
Yeah, where else do you want to go?
Okay, I've never driven one of these. I'm just curious. For a long period of time... the way the taxation in Italy fell, it simply wasn't
possible. I know what
you're
going to say.
It wasn't sensible to build cars with engines of more than 2 litres, which gave a company like Ferrari a bit of a headache. So instead of a 308 GTB having a 3-litre naturally aspirated engine, they sleeved the engine down, created what was at the time the world's smallest V8, a 2-litre V8. And they did it in naturally aspirated and turbocharged form.
Oh, I didn't know they did NA ones. God, how wheezy were those?
They had about 180 horsepower, so they were probably pretty wheezy. I'm trying to remember who I spoke to who has driven ones. Probably, I mean, it may not be Harry, but it will be someone like Harry Metcalf has driven. I've spoken to someone who's driven a 208 turbo and said it's so much better than you think it's going to be.
Really?
Yeah, you'd think it would be horrible and laggy and everything else. And he said, it's not brilliant. It's probably not as nice as a 308, but it's pretty good.
What's it have, sort of 250 horsepower or something?
Yeah, it had almost the same amount of horsepower. I mean, you know, obviously Ferrari weren't necessarily entirely bang on with their horsepower claims back in the late 70s. But it was an equivalent amount of power. But of course, it probably came with a shed load more torque. than the 308 had. So I think it was actually quite an effective device, and I've never driven one, and I'd really like to.
That is interesting. I'd like to try the naturally aspirated one.
Yeah.
Tiny, tiny little V8. It's funny, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think other than, you know, things that have been created by putting two four-cylinder motorcycle engines together, I think it probably is still the smallest V8 that's ever been created by a motor manufacturer.
That's cool. That's very cool.
Yes.
I've got just a couple of curios.
I've got a curio.
I'd never heard of this before. I didn't know that until I started researching it this morning. But the Mark 1 Toyota MR2, there was a supercharged version.
There was.
So it had 145 horsepower, up from 122, the standard car. But that's, I mean, that must have weighed nothing. Good response, decent amount of power in a tiny little two-seater sports car. That's probably quite fun. I have no idea what those early MR2s were like.
They were great.
Were they?
Oh, my goodness. The first MR2. Mm. So the first ever, I think I'm right. Oh, maybe I'm not right. I was about to say, the first ever auto car handling day, Britain's best driver's car, as they call it these days, which was, I think, in 1989. I was about to say an MR2 won it. I'm now slightly nervous about that because an MX-5 might have won it. I can't remember what won it. But I know that an MR2 was there, and it did unbelievably well. Mm. Those first generation cars with those gorgeous little twin cam engines in them, they handled brilliantly. The only problem with them was that they had unassisted steering, and they had a very big steering wheel and quite a slow rack. Other than that, they were absolutely mega. I love those things.
So the second generation MR2, it has a reputation for being a bit vicious, a bit spiteful, doesn't it?
Yeah. So yeah.
Has that?
Are you going to ask me? Yeah. Well, whether it was deserved?
Has that done the MR2 as a whole a sort of disservice? Because no one ever talks about MR2s as being great driver's cars. Not really. Not like an MX-5 or whatever else.
No. Well, okay. So the Gen 1 cars absolutely deserve to be thought of as like that. Actually, but in many ways, they're a much more sophisticated car than an MX-5. You know, they're mid-engine. Mm. You know, they were, you know, they rev to 7.8, I think. Mm. I mean, they really, really sang. I'd rather have an MR2 than an MX-5 of the same era. I absolutely would. Those early MR2s, I guess they're really, really underrated, and I suppose the problem now is finding a good one. I imagine that would be a very, very difficult thing to do.
Sure.
I'm sure they've all just been eaten away. Yeah. And the other thing about them was, although they had this... Okay, so I won't tell you why, but I had cause, before I was ever a motoring journalist, to drive one of these things to the south of France and back. Oh, yes, I was one of these stupid sort of Sloaney scavenger hunts, which idiots used to do back then. And I did it in one of those. And, you know, we had a lot of fun getting down there, but when we had to come back, we just got on the motorway and drove back from the south of France to London in a day. And I can just remember thinking it was really good even at that.
Mm.
Decent sized boot in it.
They do sound nice.
Yeah. Quite comfortable. You know, quite short gears, so not the quietest things in the world, but just, like, you know, I think if you drove a really good one, I think you would be amazed. I think you come away and you think, why are people not always talking about these things? Why aren't people talking about these things with the same reverence that they talk about, you know, MX-5s and, you know, and that sort of thing.
Interesting.
But yeah, so the answer to your question is the second generation cars definitely had a reputation for dodgy handling. It wasn't as deserved as others would have you believe, but they weren't easy. Mm. So the first one you could just throw around and skid about, and it was delightful. The second ones did. You could get to a point where if they went, they stayed gone. Mm. But they weren't anything like as difficult as some made out. I think there was also, wasn't there a turbo version of that second generation car which never got sold over here?
Yep.
Because there was a standard car with an 8-valve engine, and there was like something called GT which had a 16-valve engine, and then there was a turbo which had like 200 horsepower.
God, that's probably quite quick, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I never drove it. So I couldn't answer your next question, but... yeah.
Go on then. But give us. I think we've got time for one more of yours, unless you've got loads you want to rattle through.
I don't have loads I want to rattle through. I talk about this too often on this podcast, but I'll say it again. Golf Limited.
Yeah. Okay. So was that Germany only, that car?
And I think it was Germany only. I mean, they made handfuls of them. So for anybody who wasn't listening to the last time I banged on about this, this was a Series 2, a Gen 2 Golf. Okay. And the thing is that they made engines for Golfs and Corrados. Some had 16 valves. Some were supercharged. They only ever made one engine which had 16 valve and was also supercharged, and they stuck it in this thing called the Golf Limited. And give you an idea of what it did, a Golf GTI of that era had, I think, 112 horsepower.
Mm.
This had 215.
That is unbelievable, isn't it?
Better still, and what was so utterly brilliant about the Limited was that, you know, whereas the Golf GTIs came with the three-door shell and had the sort of the red piping round the grille and four headlights and all this go-faster stuff, the Golf Limited was, I mean, it looked like a Golf L. Five-door shell, single headlights, nothing on it.
Yeah,
I think it had a little blue line round the grille just to tell anybody who actually really, really knew, okay, you know, fast car coming. And they were just brilliant. They were, I only ever drove one. I probably only drove it for a day, but you know, 30 something years, it's still in there. So it must've been pretty useful.
Mm.
And I don't think, as I say, I don't think that was not only was it not sold in the UK, I don't think it was sold anywhere other than in Germany.
And we promise not to talk about it for another 3 weeks.
Okay. Can I do one we've never talked about?
Go on.
And actually I've never driven one of these, and oh my goodness, I want to drive one of these.
Yes.
If I say to you 333i,
I read about one this morning, a South Did African you? Special.
The South African,
yeah.
Six-cylinder E30 M3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With input from Alpina, I think.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, I haven't researched it fully.
It was the same sort of power as an E30 M3. I think it had sort of 200 horsepower.
Mm.
But it did it with a 3.2-litre straight six rather than a 2.3-litre straight four. And they only made 200 of them. I guess if they're South African built, they would all have been right-hand drive.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds cool.
Okay, if anybody knows about one of these things and one that might be in the UK, please let us know. I want to have a go. I mean, wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
We could borrow BMW's E30 M3.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
That's a story, isn't it?
I wonder if there's a single one in the UK. If there is, we need to go and hunt it down, don't we?
Someone must have brought one over. Come on.
Okay.
Everybody listening to this, find me a 333i.
Yes. Get on it. Get on social media, whatever it takes. Get on the forums. Well, okay. 333i.
Okay.
That's your last one then. We'll leave it there.
I think I'm done.
I think, oh God, we have missed out on some great cars in the UK. Also some terrible ones. We'll leave it there. And before we do the listener question, I'm just going to remind you all to follow the podcast or subscribe to the podcast, whatever app you're using. Please just do that for us, because it means that we can find a bigger audience. It also means you don't miss a single episode. And the bigger the audience gets, the more and more we can do with this podcast. It just gets better. So please just hit the follow button or the subscribe button. Right, now the listener question, it was asked to me in person at Bicester Heritage on Sunday. And I didn't catch the chap's name, I'm sorry, but I remembered your question. He's got a Cayman R, yep. And he wants to know if he should swap into a first-gen Cayman GT4. It's a fun car, but he does big trips, so it's not a daily. These things are always so hard to answer.
So he does big trips in other cars, it's purely recreational.
It's a recreational car, but he does big trips in it, yeah.
Yeah,
It's always hard to answer these questions because these things are so personal. But you can only offer your point of view. Would you, I guess, putting money to one side, would you rather have, for fun and for high days, a Cayman R or a Cayman GT4?
God, that's so difficult.
Yeah,
because I think the Cayman R, it might be the most underrated Porsche of modern times. Because it's, you know, I just don't think most people. I think there'll be people listening to this and go, "Oh, I just want to remind you, what's a Cayman R?" But then again, a GT4 is just that bit more, isn't it? It's just that bit more of, frankly, everything.
Mm.
And those first generation cars would actually be pretty good. I mean, you're also not talking about a like-for-like amount of money, are you?
Not quite.
Yeah, so I think my answer is, you know, if money isn't a big determinant, probably the GT4, but I wouldn't want anyone to think that I was dissing the Cayman R because of it, because it's not, because I think Cayman R's are absolutely brilliant cars.
Yeah, I've never driven a Cayman R. Maybe I need to put that right. But I have, back in the, particularly the facelift cars from 2009, 2009, I think, the Cayman S, such a gorgeous thing to drive. And yeah. It's, I mean, they're getting on now, aren't they? Almost 15 years old now. So probably they feel a bit leggy, some of those cars. But if you can find a good Cayman R, I bet it is a gorgeous thing, because the S was lovely in itself.
I mean, for the money, I might even have a Cayman R. And certainly for the money, for as a recreation, I probably would. But as I say, if the money's not important and you need to do a big distance, I'd probably go for a GT4, but not by much.
So thank you. Please keep your listener questions coming. We like ending the podcast that way. You can either tweet us, or you can send us a direct message on Instagram, or you can email us info@the-intercooler.com. If you come up with a good question, we'll answer it, and we will do so again next week.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.